Hello and welcome back to Structures of Self, the podcast that looks at environmental impacts on mental and physical health. I am your host, Aubrey Stark Miller, and today we will be talking about the mental health industrial complex. Okay, so I'm just going to hop right into this. The mental health industrial complex. What is that? You may be familiar with the military industrial complex, right? And all of that stuff. We're not going to get into that. It's this idea that there is this whole system and structures that are operating in a way that benefits the system, benefits the people inside, may not be beneficial to the population at large, and has some, whether you want to classify it as like ulterior motives or suspicious motives or problematic, just being problematic for society or for individuals. So I wanted to take a look at this because I became familiar with the term mental health industrial complex only quite recently. It was just within the past couple months or so. There was a couple people on Instagram that I follow who were talking about environmental impacts on mental health. And talking about like how capitalism and systemic racism impact mental health and diagnoses. And they had given me an article or mentioned this article, a research paper, not just an article, a research paper by Dr. Eric Green. And this paper, it's called The Mental Health Industrial Complex, A Study in Three Cases. It's from the Journal of Humanistic Psychology. It was released in 2019, so very recent. And it's essentially saying, okay, our biomedical system of the traditional model of diagnosing a illness through the DSM is diagnosing an internal problem within your brain, right? And the mental health industrial complex is saying, okay, we need to question that model because that model isn't taking into consideration environmental factors. So let me just go back and say, okay, so I became interested in this paper. I was interested in the fact that these researchers are looking at environmental impacts on health. I was really interested in the idea of pushing back on the biomedical model, and I'll tell you why. So some of the research that I do and the impetus for my research relates to my own personal experiences. I obviously, the majority, everything that I experience and everything and my perceptions of the world are through the lens of my experience. I can never change that. So inherently, I do have biases in terms of what I am researching and what I am interested in. And mental health has been a very big thing in my life for a really long time. I've experienced mental illness since I was a kid. Since I was very young, Okay, so I'm going to get into some things here. If you want to pause, if you don't, it's not going to get like super juicy or dark, but if you do want to pause, I am going to be talking about anxiety and depression and suicide ideation and some severe anxiety attacks. Wasn't necessarily thinking about getting into my mental health today, but I think it's important in order to unpack my perspective before getting into this conversation because, you know, in any sort of research, you know, when we try to like deliver science as being like unbiased or like this in this neutral bubble, it's never true. it's never real. So I want to be honest about what my perspective is on this, because it gives context and I think it's important. And then you can kind of take from there what you will. All right. So yeah, so there's my disclaimer. So let's see, going back to as far back as I can remember, like when I was very young, there were periods of time where, I experienced very high, intense feelings of depression, worthlessness, a lack of purpose. Like I was very, very young. I was probably like 7 or 8. And I remember thinking that I would not live to become an adult. And I wasn't really sure why, but I was overwhelmed by the idea of being an adult, but I also was just convinced that I wasn't going to make it, that I would be dead before I was an adult. So I grew up, let's just keep giving more and more context. I'll give you a little bit and then I'll go backwards, and then I'll give you a little bit and then I'll go backwards again. Get organized, Aubrey. God. Okay. So I grew up in Vermont. I'm a white woman. I'm now 34 years old. I grew up in a very small town in Vermont. If you don't know what Vermont is, it's one of the states in the United States, in New England. It's very cold. It's also very beautiful in the spring and summer. It gets super green and it's like amazing hiking. So go to Vermont and spend your money there because they need it. So I grew up in a really small town. I had two towns. I grew up in Fairfield, Vermont. Technically East Fairfield. I grew up in East Fairfield. I don't know what the population of Fairfield is, but it's really freaking small. And I lived with my dad there. And it was like very, like there was a town, but we were like miles away from the town. I attended school and I saw people there, but I didn't really see many people when I was at home, which was most of the time. And then I also lived in a small town called Westford, Vermont, and a population around 2,000 people. Less, probably less, but it's around there. Didn't live quite as far out in the middle of nowhere, but it's still very rural. I wouldn't say that I got together with people very often. I say that because I've talked about socialization before. I think that social contact is a essential, like if not one of the most essential aspects of mental health and health in general. So I will say, like, yeah, I was pretty isolated in these environments. And so, yeah, I grew up in a space where I also did experience, I experienced various kinds of trauma when I was very young, related to family. My parents separated like 5 times. There was a lot of intensity in my relationships with my mother and my father. There was a lot of change happening. I had a stepbrother and he was removed from the home. My dad had a girlfriend with stepkids and then they moved out. So there was a lot of fluctuation in my environment, and I definitely had a lot of mental health issues in part because of that. So I had a lot of anxiety attacks. We called them tantrums, but they were just like, I couldn't handle my shit. The world felt really overwhelming and I couldn't figure out how to mediate between the frustration inside me and the lack of ability to do anything. Like I felt like I couldn't do anything externally. So I cycled between very high anxiety and depression, and I guess you could call, well, like very high aggression too. I was very aggressive at times. And that was my reality for a long time. I was also like, I was a really good student. I was a really good kid. I straight A student. I had friends sort of, but I was usually kind of alone. And let's narrow this in, Aubrey. Okay, so that's some of my mental health background. And when I was a teenager, I ended up, well, so I'd thought about suicide off and on since I was very young. It wasn't regular, but it did happen occasionally. And when I was a teenager, I became more aware of the concepts of depression and anxiety, and like, I understood that there were people who were taking medication for these things, antidepressants, etc. I was never officially diagnosed with anything. I self-diagnosed. I had therapists who would throw terms out there, but I mean, they told me I had clinical depression and anxiety. They never said like anxiety disorder or anything, but I mean, that was what was being alluded to. And then there was also later in life, substance use in my late teens and early 20s. And so there was another diagnosis/label of alcoholic that was attached to me. And these labels, at one point, I liked the label of depression. I liked being able to name something, but I also simultaneously felt like I was drowning in it. It was like this warm blanket that comforted me, but also suffocated me. We're getting real today, folks. And I didn't like the anxiety. The anxiety attacks, like when I'd be at school and I'd be like shaking uncontrollably and screaming at people who came near me. That I didn't like. I didn't like that. And so my point being, these diagnoses were, they were helpful in a way, but they ultimately just had me, I just sank lower into these things. They became more and more of my identity. When I went to college, I essentially tried to just disown all of it and just act like nothing had ever happened. I had had a suicide attempt when I was in high school. I was 17. And going into college, I wanted to distance myself, but I was still depressed. But it like got way better. Like when I went to college, things changed. But I was told by various people that like, well, no, you still have this. Even if you feel better, you still have something. And for years, I kind of toggled between identifying with it or not identifying with a diagnosis. I didn't want the alcoholic label whatsoever. Wasn't about that. But I had it. Like, it was given to me. It wasn't even a choice. And as a behavior, or as a result, I felt that my behavior, it was a self-fulfilling prophecy that if, like, I was told that my drinking, no matter what, would be out of control, that there was this problem internally with me, and that there was nothing I can do about it, and that the only thing I can do is give up control even more and face this identity that I had. Now, I know that some people feel that a diagnosis is beneficial to them. And it's like, okay, I'm naming the thing. I'm giving words to the thing that I feel that is like all over the place, where you're fucking everything inside you and around you is just, it's in state of flux. And so by naming it, it's like, all right, I'm going to put this in a box. My question is like, what does that box really do for you? And for some, I mean, you might have answers and that's great. And I'm down to have a dialogue about it. But what I want to get into today is talking about how that diagnosis, it's actually serving to perpetuate those problems and make an individual feel even more out of control, rather than addressing the environmental aspects. It only serves to internalize a problem, create senses of shame, and ultimately be more harmful than good, when we could be looking at, in tandem, the environmental factors. So it's like, I don't want to say to anyone, what you're experiencing isn't valid, or isn't real, or that another lens through which I have had many conversations about this, and I do think about a lot, is how, as a white woman, you know, is it that my privilege allows me to just remove that label in a way that a person of color or someone else in a different position cannot remove that label? I mean, everything I experienced was real. I was depressed. I was anxious. But it's the label and the diagnosing that I think is problematic. Like, I needed help in addressing my mental health, in part by addressing the environment and saying like, hey, you have a really, really, really hard environment. And there's some things that are hurting you. And so those things need to be addressed. But it doesn't mean that there's something wrong with your brain, or that your brain chemistry is off, or that you're broken. Your quote-unquote brain chemistry, and this is a really important distinction. I'm not going to get too much into the technical medical components today, but I'll put this out there. Yes, your brain chemistry is altered by, it may be quote-unquote altered, we'll just leave it at that, but it's not necessarily because you were born this way. It is in part a result of your environmental factors. Okay, so I know this is going to be, this is a sensitive topic, and this is a very complex topic. So I really want to be, you know, respectful of everyone's experiences, but I'm gonna push some buttons potentially today with some things here. So I'll conclude, I'm not concluding, but I, in terms of my personal experience and why I'm getting into this research, is that I got to the point where I felt I'm no longer depressed, and I don't, especially like, so with depression, anxiety, those things really weren't plaguing me in the way that they had when I was younger, in part because I got into fitness, I had different social groups, I had healthier interactions, I had gone back to school, I had made some drastic changes in my life, like huge changes. And so I no longer was afflicted with these things. And so when someone was like, oh, well, you still have depression, it's just dormant, I was like, I don't think that's true. And I think if I carry that with me, then that just makes me like prone to anxiety, that it's just going to pop up again, which in turn then affects my mental health. You see what I mean? Like, if you think that that's like just waiting behind door number two perpetually, that in and of itself is affecting your whole framework of how you view the world and how you treat yourself and how your quote-unquote sense of self operates. And I couldn't do that. And so it was the same thing with being called an alcoholic. I was like, I think this is so much bigger than just whether or not I have a quote-unquote disease or I have a genetic predisposition or anything. Like, yeah, I drank a lot. I drank a fuck ton. I was probably nearly to the point of dying. Not, like, I wasn't in a gutter or anything, but I was, like, I was at times drinking a lot. And I had at one point been told by a doctor that my liver wasn't doing very well. And so, yeah, like, it was very serious, but it was, like, the terminology and, like, the labeling is, like, this thing that removes this label that says, like, something's wrong with you. It removes your agency. It removes your sense of control in the world. And I understand that some recovery programs are like, oh, you have to give up control. I think that's so flawed, because as humans, you have to have some sort of level of control. You have to feel that you have a sense of agency. And if you don't, then your ability to take action gets further diminished. So think about this. If you are someone who is like lower income or a person of color, and if you are being treated by the systems, like the systems are stripping you of basic human rights and are stripping you of the ability to advance socially or economically and are perpetually putting you down and you don't have control, that's what leads to substance use, is this coping with this existential crazy shit, this very real oppression. And then for someone to turn around and be like, well, you need to give up control, that your ego is just too big and you are just trying to control too many things and you need to let it go. No, that's not... We need control. We need empowerment. Holly Whitaker talks about this in her book, Quit Like a Woman, related to substance use and alcohol. And this is one of her core things, is that, as a woman, we've already given up, we've already been robbed of so much power by society that why would we give up even more? We don't have any. I think that her scope, is limited in some ways in terms of looking through like a white woman lens. Her book is really good, but it doesn't necessarily talk about the environments as much as I would necessarily in terms of these structural components. But I that was a very influential thing for me. And when I first stopped drinking, was like, yes, I need to be empowered. I need control. I need to have autonomy and agency. I also need to understand the systems that are at play. Like, it was by understanding these systems around me in which I am enmeshed, inextricably enmeshed within systems of capitalism and white supremacy, social hierarchy. I can't do anything I can't undo those systems, but I need to know how those things impact me, rather than thinking that this is a failure of self, rather than thinking that this is a matter of my quote-unquote ego too big. I can't stand the ego language. I'm not into it. I'll save that for another episode. But to this point, it's like, why are we're constantly turning it back on ourselves. This is a mechanism of individualism. This is a mechanism of capitalism that is serving to point the finger at ourselves and put responsibility and blame. It's rather than understanding how these external mechanisms influence our behavior and our actions and deprive us of this agency and control and ego, whatever you want to call it. Getting a little ahead of myself, but this is the background for me. This is where I'm coming from. And so when I started getting interested in environmental psychology and looking at like environmental design and how our environments affect us, and like sociology, I was like, wow, this is Like this, I started getting interested in this before I stopped drinking, and that was a catalyst for me. That was how I addressed my mental health and how I addressed my my physical health and sobriety. I don't not drink because I think that I have a problem or because I think I'm an addict or that I have a disease. I don't drink because alcohol is a literal poison and it's not healthy for anyone. I will just say as a sidebar, I'm not anti-drug use at all, actually. And depending on the substance, I don't have any qualms about people using it. I don't make this distinction between addict or not. I think it depends a whole lot on your environment and there's a lot of reasons why people use substances. I personally don't use alcohol anymore because it does things to your metabolism and your organs and your mental health. And the list goes on and on. It's a carcinogen. Like drinking a bottle of wine is just like smoking a pack of cigarettes. Like don't quote me exactly on that, but like it's the research shows like it's an equivalent on some length. Google it. Let me know if I'm right or wrong. I do know it's a carcinogen. So like why is cigarette smoking bad, but drinking is not, you know, why are we making that distinction? That's a whole other episode. Anyways, it's a little bit of background on me. I'm going to take a quick break, but so this was quite the intro, right? The point of today's episode is to get into, how these systems that we are enmeshed in, the culture, the constructs of American society, how these things are integrated and intertwined with the mental health system, and how the mental health system itself is deeply flawed and is perpetuating systems of social and economic inequality and white supremacy. So after this brief message, we will be back to talk about more. I will be back. The royal we. Okay. To structures of self. All right. So the mental health industrial complex. So as I mentioned earlier, so I had done reading from this case study by Dr. Eric M. Green. This is from 2019 in the Journal of Humanistic Psychology. The title of this research piece is The Mental Health Industrial Complex, A Study in Three Cases. So this was based off of Eric's research as dealing with patients in the psychiatry. He was working in West Philadelphia, and his patients were predominantly Black and male, and the patients here in this particular case study are three Black males who are, there are two of them are younger, one of them is like very young and one's a teenager, and then the third one is a man in his mid-40s, I believe. And a couple questions that Dr. Green is posing is like, okay, so he opens the paper by saying, you know, we've started to look at various fields through a lens of systemic racism and social and economic inequality as a result of capitalism. And those fields are, you know, educational institutions, the workforce, the medical field, real estate. So if you look at like redlining and real estate, and you look at like impartial and biased care in the medical field and discrimination in the workforce and discrimination in educational institutions, which all has, you know, long-term consequences, as the research shows, on, in particular for Black Americans to thrive and to, you know, live lives as, on an equal setting as white people. And this is not specifically just related to Black people, you know, racism affects anyone who isn't white. So, I mean, that's what white supremacy is that if you are not in a system, a systemic white supremacy, if you are not white, then you are not going to be holding the reins of power. So, mental health. How does this relate to mental health? Well, you know, I mentioned in the boys' friendships episode, I mentioned how bias and bias influences decisions of researchers, and I talked about how, like, this research was finding that boys have very intimate friendships, but that prior research wasn't finding that because the researchers themselves were biased in thinking that boys don't have intimacy or friendships. So, in terms of looking at the whole system of mental health, you have to look at how this is a system that the Western medical diagnoses system is. We tend to think of these larger institutions as unbiased, as neutral. You know, it's follow the science, and it is the neutral party that is just going around helping people or making diagnoses, etc., but that it doesn't inherently have any biases. And Dr. Eric Green is saying, no, that's not true, because these systems developed within a system of white supremacy. It developed within a system of capitalism that inherently creates a system of inequality and is perpetuated by this. Now, I don't know if any of you have listened to or remember my episode on happiness. I did a two-part episode, and this was back in the fall of 2019. So I did a two-part episode on happiness, and the first part was with my former co-host Courtney, and this part two was by myself. It was my first solo episode, and that was a life-changing episode for me. That was life-changing research, honestly, in how I look at the world. So there's this quote. So I did this. I was very interested in happiness initially because I was interested in it through the lens of positive psychology, and I felt that, like, you know, these American narratives around, like, always being positive, toxic positivity, which is more mainstream now to talk about. But, you know, at the time I was like, why are we constantly forced to be positive? And what is this, what is in the nature of our culture that perpetuates these narratives that, like, everything is fine when in fact, you know, millions of Americans are economically insecure. We have massive social and racial inequality and racial oppression. So that was, like, some of the origin of why I wanted to get into that. But then I ended up finding this book called The Happiness Industry by William Davies, and it blew my mind. So there was this one quote that I thought was really, because it starts out by talking about happiness and various forms of, like, happiness in American society and how we're, like, monetizing off of it and, like, you know, telling people they have to be happy, and if you're not, then you're failing, and then buy our product and this will fix you. You know, the common capitalistic consumeristic component, but now woven into our subjective well-being. They've always been looking to address our well-being. But anyways, and so it starts out looking at that, and then it delves into this really fascinating history about the field of psychology itself. I want to just touch on a couple different quotes from that book, because I read this and I was like, oh, holy shit, this goes way deeper than I think. And I don't want to make this sound like, I'll go so deep, conspiracy theories, ooh, Aubrey. The history here, I'm a history buff. It goes into the history of the field of psychology, and it is just so fascinating to think about how we created these systems that will reinforce white supremacy and keep poor and black and brown people from being able to question their status in society, and if they feel uncomfortable that we are and that they are mentally distressed, that we diagnose this as an internal problem rather than, you know, addressing externally. So one of the quotes was, to understand these trends as historical and sociological does not in itself indicate how they might be resisted or averted, but it does have one great liberating benefit of diverting our critical attention outward upon the world and not inward upon our feelings, brains, or behavior. So I start with that one because this is a basis, or, you know, one of the factors of why I make this podcast in the first place. Even before I found this literature that, like, had me reframing how I view mental health system, going back to the beginning, the whole point of this podcast is to understand how our environments are affecting us internally, to remove that shame and remove that individualized notion, that individualized responsibility, as if there's like an internal moral and physiological failing, you know, whether it's related to making lifestyle choices or behavior changes, that understand, or your mental health, your physical health, that understanding that the environment is playing a role in what's happening inside you. Now, when I talk about this, and I've addressed this before, but when I talk about these environmental structures, some people are like, okay, Aubrey, that's really overwhelming, that's really big. But these systems, I'd rather understand how these systems affect me and affect the people around me rather than being told that, like, everything is my fault, that there's an internal mechanism that's wrong, because that can perpetuate inaction. I think that there's more, if you address the external and the environmental components, you can see, okay, well, then what do we address here, rather than perpetually telling someone, oh, you have to do the work, but they're in a system in which they can't do, quote unquote, do the work. And then you tell them, well, if you can't do the work, then you're failing. And so it just creates this perpetual cycle, which leads to anxiety, depression, a lack of agency, and a lack of communal support. Because if you think that you're doing something wrong, you're not going to reach out to someone else because you don't want to admit that you have done something wrong. Now, in terms of mental illness and mental health, there's been a lot of stigmas that have been, they're removing the stigmas, right? And it's, they be like, as a culture, things are shifting, and it's really important to acknowledge how people are feeling and what they're experiencing internally, to be sure. And I don't want to discredit that. I think I mentioned earlier, but I want to reiterate, like, I don't want to discredit what people are experiencing and the legitimacy and the validity of those feelings. But I think we need to go beyond, you know, like, right now it's becoming more common to, like, destigmatize taking medicine. And then we should accept that people need medicine in order to survive. I don't accept that. I thoroughly do not accept that. Yes, I understand how it helps people on an individual basis, but, like, that's not the root of it, right? There's other factors at play that can be addressed in tandem rather than just giving someone a pill and saying, well, this is your life sentence. This is because you have something wrong with your brain. Because there's nothing wrong with your brain. Your brain is reacting to an environment that is problematic. There's nothing wrong with our brains. Okay, so I read this book, so Happiness Industry, and I saw this looking at how we shift things. And the book goes on to talk about specifically how mental health, it talks about positive psychology, But it talks about like the origins of mental health and how we have created a pathology for human behavior. So, you know, people, we talk about like, you know, people get depressed, they get upset, they get anxious. And again, as a reaction to an environment, but that the medical system has grown into such a way that we have been creating a pathology around these behaviors. And in so doing, we're creating this intertwine between the diagnosis model and the pharmaceutical approach, where we're saying that instead of understanding that like a mental response or like a mental symptom is perhaps a proportionate and understandable response to external circumstances, psychiatry is saying that it's an individual problem and that individually you should take medicine in order to handle that. So the happiness industry goes on to talk about how capitalism plays a role in the mental health system, and it goes on to talk about the individualization of things. I'm not going to get into the happiness industry today because I already did that episode, and I'm thinking now of maybe doing another episode from a different lens. But going back to Dr. Eric Green, all right, so doing this work and finding that like how this, there's these connections between functions of the state and big business, and how there's a focus on the biological mechanisms, and rather than the environmental components. And they talk about how the emphasis on the biological model is in part to shift away from the perception and the models that would say that what your behavior is a result of poor behavior, of moral failure, and of sin. So it's an important thing to address too, is that and this is partially why the term alcoholism exists, or it's the reason why it exists, is because, you know, drinking and the behaviors related to it and the personality problems were viewed as like a moral failure, or like, you know, you have the choice to act better and you are not. And so it was the medicalization of substance use helped to get people recognition and validated, and to say like, okay, well, I have a disease. There's nothing wrong with my, there's something wrong with my brain. It's not that I have moral failure or I'm a bad person. It's that I have a medical condition. And I don't doubt that that has served to help many people in getting care, but it doesn't stop at the biological component is what is important to acknowledge. That like, it's not a dichotomy of either you are a bad person and you have chosen to do certain things. And this relates both to substance use and mental health. It's not a bad matter of either you're a bad person or you have a disease and you have a biological predisposition to do this thing. It's just not that simple is the thing, is that it's not one or the other. And that's what's important to note, is that like there is a biological mechanism in part as a result of external factors. Now, I think also what comes into play here is this question of agency and autonomy, or at least that's what I think about too, is like, okay, well, if I say that, you know, you are it's not your bad behavior and that you're not necessarily in control of your behavior because of these external factors, does that make people feel hopeless? Well, I'd say that either way, we need to address the environmental factors. So address the environmental factors, make things healthier and better for people in a vessel as which behavior could stand to change either way. And you don't have to label it as quote unquote bad behavior or not. I digress. Okay, so this psychological treatment, the psychopharmacological treatment, it conditions patients to think of their mental health as coming from a dysfunction of the brain rather than the social context in which they live. And so that creates a problem. It's because it's being referred to as psychologization, and meaning that, quote, the current ruling ontology denies any possibility of a social causation of mental illness. So the problem is in part that it's not bad to name things, to name what's going on internally. But what's happening is that we're naming things and we're saying this is a flaw in your biological makeup, rather than saying, I see that you have this experience. This could be because of your environment. And so when we put it as an internal thing, it's keeping people who are oppressed looking inward and perpetuates the cycle or like hierarchies. So like, for instance, what do you think happens when you have higher rates of mental illness in lower income and populations of color, lower income populations and populations of people of color, and they are told that there's something wrong with them and that there's like a flaw within their makeup, and then meanwhile we have wealthier and white people with much lower rates of mental illness. This just serves to cause people, again, to just look internally and to only think that there's something wrong with them rather than questioning anything around them, including the systems in which put them in the situation in the first place. Green quotes from Fanon from 1963, who writes, "Imperialism leaves behind the germs of rot which we must clinically detect and remove from our land, but from our minds as well." And this is where this phrase comes up that I really like, is decolonizing your mind, decolonizing your consciousness, and understanding how the systems in which that are perpetuating social and racial hierarchy are also influencing how we view our mental health. So there's from another writer from 1956 writes, "Many psychiatrists and psychologists refuse to entertain the idea that society as a whole may be lacking in sanity. They hold the problem of mental health in a society is only that of the number of quote-unquote unadjusted individuals and not a possible unadjustment of the culture itself." I've touched on this before in regards to like environmental design. So, you know, we rather than questioning the environmental design and whether or not, you know, the homes that we build or the design of our cities, et cetera, are problematic, we only see that, you know, someone isn't good at getting a job, or someone is experiencing anxiety, or someone is being irritable, and like looking at these like personality traits and biological traits. Whereas we can see that when you have poorly built design in structures, or like the homes that you live in, like poorly built homes can perpetuate problems of higher rates of crime and higher instances of mental illness, can perpetuate other things related to health. So if you look at like a physical structure and how that affects health, you can also look at the social structure of and related to mental health and mental illness, and see how that there's a connection there. In it's nothing wrong with the people themselves. It's a problem with the systems in which we're operating. Okay, so this colonization of consciousness. This is such an important phrase. I'm so glad I read this article. So there's a doctor, Robert Zaslavsky, who is also quoted in Dr. Green's work. And Dr. Robert Zaslavsky coined the term, the current quote-unquote culture of incapacity. So Dr. Green says it elicits a mantras of self-blame while exploiting humans as patients for the bottom line dollar. In short, the definition, diagnosing, and treatment of mental illness is political. So this culture of incapacity, what do you think about that? Culture of incapacity and the colonization of consciousness. We operate in systems that perpetually tell people, you know, like individualism and bootstrapping. It tells someone who's already poor, who's already disenfranchised, who's already discriminated against, that they're not working hard enough, and that they are, it's an internalized mechanism, and that there's something wrong. It's a moral failing. It's a self failing within themselves. And so with mental illness, it's a similar mechanism where it's telling you that there's something wrong with your brain, and that there's something wrong with you, and that there's nothing you can do about that. That's creating this culture of incapacity. It is further diminishing an individual's ability to develop in a multitude of ways, and most importantly, it is preventing them from questioning the systems in which we exist. It's preventing them from questioning the white supremacy in which our society is built on and embedded in. And while this case study is specific to where Dr. Green is working, and these specific case studies, it does beg the question of like how medical officials are viewing these things in general. So, for instance, one of the psychiatrists that Dr. Green worked with was speaking about poor black patients and said, quote unquote, "We should just drop a bomb on this whole community and end their suffering. They are evil and broken. They can't help themselves. All they do is act like wild animals, and there is no way to help them." And when Dr. Green addressed issues of how systems of white supremacy and poverty and capitalism, et cetera, and discrimination are constantly affecting the environments in which, you know, these people are living, the response was kind of like, well, it is what it is. There's no way to change that. And so there is an awareness on the part of these medical officials, but a lack of desire to do anything about it. Because part of the problem is that these people don't see black people or poor people as human. They don't see them as worth. They may be mindful of some of these aspects in the system, but they don't necessarily see that people are worthy of changing anything in order to address that. And Dr. Green addresses the failings of like the systems in which psychologists and psychiatrists are trained, and the failings there. Dr. Green says that there's very little information afforded in the space of mainstream clinical psychology training to give clinicians tools to better understand and frame the way racism and classism affect our society, mental health, and the insidious ways that they have structured our profession. So that's not even on the table. It's not being discussed. And that's something that, like, you know, when you think about, like, how how these medical professionals get to a position where they're not treating people like humans. I mean, there's racism, and there's several instances of racism on a case-by-case basis, but then there's also a lack of education and formal training to understand how these systems affect the work that they're doing and the system that they have created. As a result, something here is really interesting is that so people of color are viewed with greater pathology, meaning that they are misdiagnosed with greater frequency than white people. They are 5 times more likely than white people to be given a diagnosis of schizophrenia. They're more likely to receive incorrect drug therapy. They are viewed as more aggressive, more psychotic, more criminal. And so, you know, they'll have, like, part of this problem, and there's layers of these problems, but, like, this system that's saying this is an internalized problem, you couple that with someone who is racist and is viewing black people or poor people as less than human or, like, not on equal grounds, and you are more likely to diagnose them with something. So again, it's rather, you know, not only are they not looking at context in the environment, but you're also not, they're inherently seeing this person as lesser than. It's similar to, like, in the education system where they realize that white teachers are treating black students differently and they're seeing them as more aggressive, or like how as a society we treat black boys as being more aggressive and not as children like they are. Like, we are treating black kids as being more as adults when they're not, they're children. So there's overlapping systems, and then what you end up having is you have a quote-unquote official, an expert, who is not looking at environmental context. They're not treating a black person or a poor person as someone who is on equal grounds, and they're seeing their behavior as more extreme, and they're adding a pathology to it. So then they're telling this person there's something wrong with you internally. So you've got several layers here of a problem that is all adding up to perpetuating systems of inequality across the board that has been given this, like, official stance because of its medical prowess and that it's like a quote-unquote official psychological diagnoses. The World Health Organization has Dr. Green talks about how they've acknowledged that the world's biggest killer and greatest cause of ill health and suffering across the globe is extreme poverty. And it says that poverty is strongly associated with deficits in children's cognitive skills and educational achievement, and disruptive behaviors are more marked in children of families facing persistent economic distress, and that poverty can affect neurobiology. So economic stress is related to poverty can lead to an increase of cortisol secretions, which increases the risk of mental illness. Also, poverty has been shown to be associated with an increased risk for schizophrenia, depression, and anxiety. So we have taken, there's so many instances of, and this is speaking to poverty, but yeah, so there's so many instances that are looking at how poverty is related to mental illness. And again, it is the behaviors and the experiences are a real thing, but, like, we're looking at the cause as an internal cause. Well, the World Health Organization is acknowledging that poverty is a problem, right? But then when you look into individual cases, you have doctors, you have psychiatrists, psychologists who are saying, no, this is an individual problem. So the WHO is saying this is systemic. We need to address poverty and how it's related to mental health. But on an individual case-by-case basis, you still have doctors and officials who are like, nope, there is a problem with your brain chemistry. And there's a problem with just with you as an individual, rather than doing anything to help the environmental context. And I touched on it earlier, but as a direct quote from Dr. Green, he says, racial minority individuals are more likely to be economically disenfranchised, putting them at higher risk for mental illness. Rather than seeing this as an effect of constraints on social and economic opportunity, the medicalization and psychologization of a person suffering by the mental health industrial complex further oppresses and stigmatizes those who are marginalized, which leads to an increased risk for mental illness. And it's that last bit that I wanted to acknowledge. And like going back to my own personal experiences is how the label made my mental illness worse. Like thinking that there was something wrong with me and that I was helpless and hopeless and like stuck this way, that I was always going to have. Like I remember talking to my mom when I was, this was just a few years ago, and I was exercising a lot, and I didn't, like, I took a week off from exercising, and I got really depressed, and I remember asking my mom, like, there's something wrong with me? Like, there's something wrong with my brain, it's my brain chemistry, and so if I don't exercise, because exercising made me feel great, exercise helped my mental health significantly, and I was like, this was in my mid to late 20s. I was 27, I think. And I remember, and so I was like, this is my life and that I have something wrong with me? And she was like, yeah, it is what it is. It's your brain chemistry. There's something wrong with you. And that further perpetuated the problem rather than looking at the fact that like I was working in a restaurant, I was miserable, I wasn't treated with respect, I socially felt inadequate and unequal to my peers, I was treated lesser than because of my status, I was drinking a lot, I was around people who were drinking a lot, it wasn't a healthy environment, but not that my mom's a doctor necessarily, but like, you know, we were both under the same misunderstanding that like, that this was an internal problem, which then led to a further issue with mental health and mental illness. It was like probably a year later that I started to question some of these things. But that, yeah, at the time, that just led me to be more depressed, and then which led me to drink more. And because I was like so overwhelmed with the idea that like, okay, if I'm not exercising every minute, then I'm just going to be like so messed up in the head, which like exercising, it's part of your environment, that's good, but it's so important to put in the context and the understanding about like how these external mechanisms, when they're not recognized, are influencing your internal makeup, and yet if the onus of responsibility is pointed at the individual, it's only going to serve to make actions and behaviors and feelings worse. And this work is, it's internalized, it's external, it's other people telling you that you have this thing and then you're internalizing it, as I had described in my own personal experience. So one of the people, there were three cases that Dr. Green focused on. One of them was this young man, John, and by the clinic, and these doctors told him that he had problematic brain chemistry. And so to quote Dr. Green, John's consciousness was shaped to ignore societal oppression and the ways in which it increased his risks for mental illness. So, and it mentions how the loss of his father directly affected his school performance. Curiously, he was diagnosed with ADHD and ODD instead of PTSD. This specific kind of diagnosis shifts the attention to brain chemistry in that PTSD, while affecting brain chemistry, serves to point to an external event which traumatizes the patient and could have been a way to help John understand the situation without self-blame. The self-blame and the shame and this like internal failing is so, so, so important. So it's like we like there are, you know, PTSD. Maybe we need to look at like how nuanced that diagnosis is, because PTSD is like applying to a whole bunch of different things. But it's looking at an environment rather than saying something is about brain chemistry, and that's really, really important. The second person that Dr. Green worked with was a young man named Tommy. So Tommy was a teenager. John, I think, John was even younger. He might have been in his very early teens or still in tweens. So Tommy, when he had been interviewed, he had, you know, behavior and that was like where he had broken into someone's house, I believe. Yeah, so he broke into someone's house, and when asked why he did it, he responded, "I don't know why. I was bored, I guessed. Hanging out with the wrong crowd, maybe I'm just damaged or broken." So Dr. Green says, quote, "Tommy's response to my question indicated that he thought his behavior was a result of a biochemical malfunction, quote unquote, maybe I'm just damaged or broken, or a personal failing, meaning I'm hanging out with the wrong crowd, all of which are variations of a mantra of self-blame." So this young man, starting from a very early age, is being taught that there's something wrong with him, there's something damaged or broken. This is so important in terms of like how you, when you already are in a system that is depriving you of your ability to thrive, right, and like succeed on a number of levels, and then to also tell you that you are damaged or broken, that will then prevent you from taking further action in the future. That affects the whole trajectory of your life. And this is what we're telling very young people. I mean, for me personally, and like, I'm not in this person's shoes, and I'm not experiencing this through the lens of systemic racism, or poverty, but I did grow up pretty poor, and that was a huge factor in development of my mental health and mental illness. But it set me on a track of like perpetuating this idea that I was broken and that there was nothing I could really do to change that. So my behaviors in part reflected that. So going on with this young man, Tommy, so he was diagnosed with bipolar disorder, and he was prescribed medication because of his age and because of having criminal behavior. So the psychiatrist concluded, quote unquote, characterological antisocial behavior was a result of a chemical imbalance, and that this imbalance helped explain why Tommy acted impulsively, erratically, and criminally. And he was prescribed some medications. So a note about bipolar disorder. From 1996 to 2004, the diagnosis of bipolar disorder rose 56%. Okay, so when we look at these diagnoses and these conditions, we are traditionally taught that they are something that you are born with. So if you are schizophrenic or you are bipolar, you have a general anxiety disorder, you have a personality disorder, even like with clinical depression. I hear people go, you know, both ways on that, where you either develop depression and then it can go away, or that you have it. Like people say, well, I have clinical depression. This really begs the question of whether or not we should be saying that we are born with a condition, or that, you know, that it's permanent, that it's not changeable. Because I know people and have read about how, like, if you consider yourself to have bipolar disorder, that this is a permanent thing. Now, I don't know, I am not well versed enough in terms of like how these things operate internally, and what kind of environmental factors and support would need to happen to quote unquote cure bipolar disorder. But I have read studies about people who say, oh, I haven't had an issue with bipolar disorder, with my bipolar, in years, but it's just, it's lying dormant. Is it lying dormant, or is it that like environmental factors have changed and there's nothing inherently wrong with you, but you experienced incredible distress for a period of time that led to a very human and natural response from your brain to handle those circumstances? So there's a quote here from, I'll just let that marinate. You know, that's just, I'm not going to say one way or another that, you know, it's not that we shouldn't diagnose people or anything, but thinking about the permanence of these things. So there's a quote here from former chair of the DSM-5 task force, Alan Francis, who argued that inflation of the kinds of mental illnesses in the DSM-5 to include everyday human emotions runs the serious risk of pathologizing normalcy, and that the definitions are based largely on subjective judgments as opposed to objective tests. The expansion of the kinds of mental illnesses also increases the profits of pharmaceutical firms who, in violation of the principles of avoiding conflict of interest in medicine, are directly tied to the psychiatrists who author the DSM-5. Okay, so there's a lot in there. I'm not going to unpack all of that right now, but the happiness industry talks about that. There's a couple other books. I'll do a post. I'm going to do a post about this on my Instagram, and I'll share some books that talk about this whole concept of like over medicalization and how there is so many ties between the pharmaceutical industry and the DSM-5. I'll have this. I don't have my exact resource or direct quote or anything, but I do remember from the happiness industry where they talk about how as the DSM, like early editions of the DSM in like the 1950s were being developed, so in tandem was pharmaceutical industries being developed, and that the pharmaceutical companies and individuals were working with people to essentially literally just like go through lists of human behavior and grouping them together and classifying them as a quote unquote disorder or disease or condition, and then working on creating medicines that they could sell for those specific conditions. And not in a good way. Like, this was not to help people. This was literally just grouping together human behaviors and saying, oh, this is a condition, and the only way you can treat this condition is with this medicine. I understand there's a lot of people out there who are like anti-pharma and big pharma, etc. I don't think that I know there's a lot of alternatives related to the wellness space, and then there's like, you know, some wild rabbit holes you can go down in terms of people not trusting medicine or science at all. I don't want to go in that direction. I don't think that that's necessary, but I do think it's really important to look at how these systems are supporting capitalism and the profits over people regarding pharmacology, pharmaceuticals, and that it's only serving to perpetuate the medicalization and pathologizing of human emotions and normal human behavior. It might not be good, like it might not be a positive experience, but okay, so someone who's living in poverty and is experiencing symptoms that are classified as being bipolar. Those are very real symptoms. I'm not saying that they're not experiencing something that is like detrimental to them as a person, but that's where we need to be addressing the environment rather than saying that you have something wrong with you and that there's a chemical imbalance that you are permanently stuck with. So going back to one of Tommy, who had been diagnosed bipolar, he didn't like the diagnoses of bipolar disorder. He said it made him feel broken and uncomfortable. And Dr. Green quote says, because diagnostic labels may serve as oppressive social and political function by marginalizing and discriminating against those who suffer from mental illness, the stigmatization of those diagnostic labels has been shown to increase the risk of mental illness. Again, as I mentioned earlier, like you may be experiencing things, symptoms of a quote unquote mental illness, but the diagnosis itself will serve to perpetuate and reinforce those symptoms. So by telling yourself or someone telling you that you have this condition, that in itself can make that condition worse. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy, perpetuating the problems and not addressing the external problems that are causing these things in the first place. The article also talks about the lens of drug use and how the intersection of drug use and mental health has a whole lot of complications. It specifically talks about cocaine and crack cocaine and the distinction there, and how I'll just throw a couple really interesting facts out. So in the early 1980s, you know, we all may be kind of aware of at least like the war on drugs, quote unquote war on drugs, and how crack in particular was focused on. So 13% of crack users were persons of color, and yet 90% of those in prison for crack-related offenses were persons of color. So there's a huge bias in terms of like who's being addressed or treated, and yet here's the thing. So there's racism and problems within the judicial system and the way we handle the treatment of drugs, 100%. But it says the mental health community was complicit as well. So there were several facilities, and they mentioned Alcoholics Anonymous specifically, that promoted the idea that the problem was in the patient, that the symptoms were a result of a disease, that it was beyond their control, and that in order for them to change, they had to admit their weaknesses. This kind of psychologization, shaped many who suffered from addictions to ignore the systemic violence that dominated their daily lives. In other words, patients were trained to turn inward and focus on their subjective problems to internally solve external problems, thereby ignoring the overwhelming oppressive systems of which they were a part. Again, this is so before getting into anything, like a summary there, I'll just mention one other case. So there was the third case was this man, Edwin, who part of the reason that I had mentioned like the crack cocaine was because this was a man who was had been a drug user. And so Dr. Green talks about how he Edwin continually referred to himself as an addict, and that he'd been in treatment facilities through his whole life. And so he learned from therapists, so in the medical space, that his addiction was his responsibility and that it was more powerful than him and that it was caused by a disease of his brain and that he needed to avoid the triggers of person, place, and things. These variations of a mantra of self-blame through the ideology of the biomedical model of mental disease continually denied significant factors such as the fact that Edwin faced a nearly impossible living situation within a racist and classist environment, one that was punctuated by violence at the hands of the police. So again, so looking at how addiction and mental health and the pathology of behavior, how these things all intertwine, how it perpetually keeps coming back to this internalized, internal mechanism of failure, of shame, of failing in terms of like your body failing, like that your brain is broken and that there's nothing you can do about it and robbing you of any control. This is the system that keeps being perpetuated by the mental health industrial complex, where people are turning into patients and consumers. It's shaping their attention so that they're inwardly focusing on a biological origin of their suffering, which further oppresses people by denying the effects of their social context. And they are internalizing that. They are like, they may be aware of how their environment is affecting certain things, but the medical officials telling them that there's something wrong with them is internalizing this. And this is the colonization of consciousness, contributing to, as mentioned earlier, the culture of incapacity. So you have these mantras of self-blame for the purpose of control, exploitation, and the bottom line, dollar. This is some stuff that it's very complex. There's a lot of information that I've thrown out here in this episode. It ended up being a bit longer than I wanted to be, but and I'm gonna do more episodes about this. I'll probably maybe not be as long, but this is so important when we look at how we how we talk to ourselves, how we are treated by the medical system, how mental health is approached, how substance use is approached, how we deal with systemic racism and systemic inequality, economic and social inequality. These problems are not internal in origin. They are external in origin and having a human response to this external environment. Yes, genetic factors are at play. Yes, it is a biological process in your brain, but it is not abnormal. And I think what's important is for me is looking at how these things are not permanent. So we've got multiple things here that, you know, I want to address is like, how can we look at mental health as related to systemic racism and systemic social inequality and economic inequality? And then how as individuals can we acknowledge that these things are not permanent and that by absorbing them as permanent, we are being perpetually oppressed by the systems. And we are removing an ability to address the systems. That we don't need to normalize mental illness in terms of it being normal to have faulty wiring. Like this is one of the questions that I always came back to when I started asking a few years ago was like, is it that more people have mental illnesses and that we are acknowledging it more? Or is it that, like, there are systemically problems that are getting much, much worse that are then causing people to have normal human reactions to it, but yet we are so deeply embedded in this system of medicalization and pathology that we fail to question the normalcy of these practices? And I think it's the latter. I think that we have been normalizing these things, and now we are at a point where we are normalizing. You know, we're talking about mental health more, and I'm glad we are. But we're normalizing just acceptance of these conditions rather than questioning the systems in which we are embedded. So yeah, this is a lot of information. And maybe you don't agree with what I'm talking about. Maybe I didn't say it in a way that was easy to digest. I mean, I feel like I was pretty straightforward, but there's a lot of material I was trying to cover. I really recommend checking out this article, The Mental Health Industrial Complex, A Study in Three Cases. There's more that, there's a few other resources in the happiness industry by William Davies, and there's some other books that, if you want to get in touch with me, find me on Instagram, AUBTRON, Obtron, or you can email me. My email and Instagram info will be in my bio, but it's Aubrey Stark Miller. It's my full name, Aubrey Stark Miller, AUBREYSTARKMILLER@gmail.com. Email me and message me and we can talk about this. If you have resources or you have thoughts about this, it needs to be talked about much more, and it is a reframing that could serve to greatly, greatly benefit us on several levels in terms of how we address these systems. Creating more communal care, creating better care for individuals, not internalizing and not individualizing these issues, and that, you know, for someone who isn't necessarily afflicted by, who's someone who's not black, someone who's white, essentially, yeah. So if you're white and you're experiencing mental illness and you're questioning like, well, okay, so how do these systems affect me, Aubrey? Well, I mean, white supremacy affects all of us. And white people benefit the most. but the social and racial stratification of our country is not healthy for any of us. The economic stratification in our country is not healthy for any of us. And these things do affect our mental health. And it's part of the other, you know, environmental components that I've talked about before, how they, there's several environmental factors that are affecting your health that, by dismantling these systems and unpacking and questioning the validity of these things, that we all stand to benefit. So anyways, yes, thank you so much for listening today. If you've listened to the whole thing, if you have any questions or comments or concerns, please, please, please feel free to reach out to me. I would love to talk to you. And I hope you all have a safe, wonderful day. Or if you're not having a wonderful day, we're still in the middle of a pandemic. I feel you. I hear you. I'm not doing well every day either. So just know that I send you my love and my heart, and we're all going to keep getting through this.